This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for dialing in as Elise Glink dials in from Think Glink Media. Hi, Elise. How are you today?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Good. You and I sound happier than most employees. You tell us that employee happiness is about as bad as it's been in a while, huh?
Yeah, so remember back, way back when, at the start of the pandemic, we had 50 million Americans who were suddenly furloughed or fired. People were pretty unhappy then. And then as we kind of went through the pandemic over the course of three and a half years, people kind of built back up and felt a lot better. They felt more comfortable that they were getting heard, that they were, you know, back in their jobs and things were going well. The employment was booming. But now what's happening is that employees seem to be experiencing a strong sense of resignation or even apathy, and they feel that employee morale overall is just getting worse. And that's according to a new study that's been done by the people who are, one guy is the author of the book Happiness at Work. And what seems to be causing all the trouble, John, is people feel like there's unfair treatment at work, inconsistent compensation, lack of support from coworkers, bosses, unreasonable workloads, and simply not being paid enough money.
So you're starting to answer my question, why all of this? I wonder if the frustration with calling people back to work or the uncertainty about it, I wonder if us bringing a hybrid world helps or hurts that equation.
Well, you know, companies keep insisting that people are happier when they're at the office, but most people in survey after survey are saying, I'm getting at least an hour and a half to 2 hours of transportation time, commuting time back. I have more control over my schedule. I can duck in and out. You're asking me to be available longer hours, but you're giving me more flexibility to manage it. So that's been actually making people happier. But now that they are being called back to the office, they have to show up maybe 3 or even 4 days a week. That's making people unhappy because when they get to the office, what they're finding is that they're still on Zoom calls with everybody else who's not back at the office. So they think to themselves, why am I sitting here facing a screen when I could be home facing a screen? And it's a fair point.
I wonder if it also is just a reflection of how people feel generally. That is, it's not work that's making you unhappy. It's the world. And so, you know, everything goes down, including your attitude about work.
Well, you know, there's a company called Delivering Happiness, which is such a good name for a company that I wish I had thought of it.
Yeah,
so,
really.
Kudos to Jen Lim, right, the CEO. She says that inflation, widespread layoffs in certain industry, and uncertainty over those return to office policies are really causing this sense of unease. It's a deep sense of what's going to happen next. And people are thinking instead of that being a good thing, like the next thing that happens to me is going to be good, so I'm going to feel optimistic, they think, oh my gosh, I'm dreading the next thing that's going to happen because it's going to be negative. And that's kind of an interesting shift in the way we see the world.
The economy is slowing down. Speaking of inflation, you just mentioned that a moment ago. That weighs on people. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Right. Bill Ackman is a billionaire hedge fund manager, and he has been, and there's always with Bill Ackman, whenever he says something, you have to bet he's betting against it, you know, or for it. You know, he's got some bet in the marketplace whenever he gets vocal. But what he's saying now is that his sense is that the economy really is slowing down. And, you know, we just saw student loan repayments restart October 1st. We have higher interest rates on credit cards, home, auto, debt. You know, people are actually paying more for cars and then paying even more to finance them. They're paying that auto loan for a much longer period of time. Remember when car loans used to be 3 years and then they were 5 years and they were 7 years? Now they're 9 years. So that's going on. And also just the higher cost of living and inflation. So we all know that inflation's come down, but a lot of people fail to realize is that the higher prices are here to stay in many cases. And so the higher levels that we're paying at the grocery store, for example, it may not go up as fast going forward, but it's unlikely that egg prices, milk prices, the price of a pound of grapes are going to go back down to where they were before the pandemic.
Elise, talk to me about mortgage rates, as high as they've been in a very long time, huh?
Oh, my goodness. In almost 23 years, we haven't seen mortgage interest rates this high. I was trying to think back 23 years ago. We were in 2000, and we had a spike of mortgage interest rates just after the recession, because there was a recession, that a tech recession, if anybody remembers back that far. And, I mean, this was a year after Google was founded. And just, it's in really, well, a couple of years. They're at their 25th, but I think that's when they may have gone public or something, back in 1998, 1999. But this is a really long time ago, and people have forgotten what it means to have a 30-year interest rate at 7.5% or 8%. If you've got the average credit score today in Illinois, you're looking to borrow a $300,000 loan, you've got 20% to put down, you'll pay a little over 8% for that 30-year loan, 7.3% for that 15-year fixed. It's just a huge jump. What that means is, of course, is that people are paying, between the rise of home prices and the rise of mortgage prices, between 40 and 50% more than a year ago for the same size house.
I wonder, pardon me, I didn't have my mic on. I wonder if after a certain point in time, that's going to be the new norm. You know, I mean, it's not 12%, it's 7%. Say it gets to 6, twice what it was beginning of the year. But I wonder if at some point people will just start to accept that and the real estate market will move on. You know what I mean?
Well, historically, and I mean by that post-World War II, right? So we're talking about the end of the 1940s all the way up until basically 23 years ago. The average interest rate for a 30-year fixed rate loan was about 8%. That was pretty normal. And then it dropped down to about 7%. And we saw in the the early 90s, we started to see mortgage interest rates come down, and then they dropped again, and then they bumped up just a little bit. And this is what you're experiencing now. It's just, you know, the 23 years goes back to that little bumping up of it, and then they came down again and again and again. It could be that we're in for a period of maybe the next couple of years where mortgage interest rates are at 7%. But to go back to what we talked about prior to the break, John, what Bill Ackman is also really concerned about is what higher interest rates are doing to the commercial real estate market. That's something that you and I have talked about before. What most people don't realize, you know, when you're an individual, you might get a 30-year loan or a 15-year loan. But when you're doing commercial property, those loans for a commercial loan are typically 5 years, and then you have to refinance them. Well, 5 years ago, you might have had a really low interest rate, maybe 2%, 3%, maybe 4% on that mortgage. It's now 4 or 5 years later, and you're looking at refinancing with an 8% or a 9% loan for commercial. Commercial rates tend to be a little bit higher than residential rates. That's going to simply be unaffordable. And what we're starting to see across the country is that even where interest rates are now, people are starting to hand back properties, hotel properties, retail malls, commercial office buildings. They're starting to hand those back to the lenders. And we could be in for a real problem, something on the order of where we were 15 years ago with the Great Recession.
So you said since the 1940s, post-World War II, the average residential mortgage rate was closer to 8% for a 30-year fixed, right?
Correct.
I wonder if there's a way to answer this question, but I wonder what's fair. I wonder what's right, right? Like maybe it's never going to be 2.5% again, and 13% is too much. And not that you got to split the difference, but I wonder where the reasonable amount is that buyers and sellers can both feel like they can manage this, they can handle it, right? And is it 6%? Is it 5%? I guess what I'm also saying, at least, is don't hold out for 3% anytime soon. Not even anytime not soon. 3% is not coming back. So stop thinking about that. Someday you're going to sell your house and you're going to And you're going to satisfy that 3% mortgage, and you're going to hate it. But you're going to have to get another mortgage someday, and it's going to be more than 3%. I wonder what the number is we should all be rooting for here, buyers and sellers.
Well, I think the number has to do more with the number of homes that go on the market than it is about the mortgage interest rate, which is a big deal, don't get me wrong. But what we would be seeing now in a normal cycle, normal economic cycle, which this is not, is that home prices would have come down in response to the higher interest rates.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It would still be affordable, but it's not, because we're 5 million homes short in this country, if not more.
That's a great answer. In other words, my question doesn't matter what the rate is. It matters what the cost is. And if the price of the house comes down, 7% times the lower house price gets you to the same cost per month that a lower interest rate would on a higher house price, right?
That's right.
So
in a normal economic cycle, the higher the interest rate, the lower the prices of the homes. But we don't have enough homes for the people who have cash who want to buy, right? Because home prices have jumped up so much. So they're using their cash to buy houses today instead of getting a mortgage. One of the reasons why the number of mortgages that are being done these days is like at a 27 or 28 year low. But we still don't have enough houses to buy, so house prices are still going up. So that's really the conundrum. How do you build more houses faster when the cost to build them is higher, the cost to, you know, finance the houses being built is higher? So there's just kind of a very weird cycle going on now that I think economists haven't faced so far.
Yeah, but you can almost imagine that that's a mechanical problem. To me, that is more solvable than the interest rate issue. Maybe interest rates will never go down, but by golly, we can make more houses. Eventually we will, I hope. Elise Glink, owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. Click on thinklink.com and listen for her next Monday. Thanks for your help today, Elise.
You're welcome, John.
Jim Dahlke is the national editor at American Inno. Click on chicagoinno.com to read some of the things he writes and helps edit. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, John. Glad to be here.
Once again, it's all about AI these days. You've got a few stories on your site about that, don't you?
That's right. Yeah. You know, AI is the talk of tech these days. And, you know, a big logistics firm in town is really leaning into AI. Of course, this is Uber Freight. So Uber Freight is the logistics division of the rideshare giant. They're based here in Chicago. It was a big win for the city when Uber Freight decided to locate its operations here in Chicago. Of course, a very big logistics town. And so Uber Freight just had, you know, kind of a big conference last week, really. And its annual customer conference, and you know, it really used that opportunity to explain how the company is using AI and the importance of AI for Uber Freight moving forward. And you know, a few things that we learned there. One, driverless autonomous vehicles are a big part of Uber Freight. They said they've done over 100,000 miles now of autonomous trucking. Of course, Uber Freight is basically its solution connects truck drivers with available shipping trucks, and so makes that process as simple as hailing a cab, picking up a big long haul truck, and they're kind of really, really disrupting the industry there. And so, you know, they're leaning into AI, especially with driverless technology, and so, you know, they expect to only see that continue to grow. Some other ways they're using AI technologies with this generative AI, which we've talked about, which is allowing the computer to essentially create the text and prompts. And they're really using that as chatbot services. So really kind of making the customer service really, really AI friendly there. At the, you know, it allows the operators of these trucking services to communicate with Uber. And so they're thinking AI really is going to speed up everything from customer service to where these trucks land.
Can you just explain to me in a little more detail how Uber Freight works?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, if you are a truck driver, you can use the Uber Freight app to find work. So you can find available, long haul shifts that, trucks that need to make it across the country. You can use the Uber Freight app to find a job that fits your schedule and take that truck across the country.
Okay, good. But then I still got to get to the truck. But once I do, then I can drive it and get paid for making that trip. Presumably, these are trucks in my area. But what was this driverless truck thing you were talking about?
Yeah, so, you know, autonomous trucking is certainly a piece of what Uber Freight is looking to do here. And so, you know, they just acquired a startup called Waabi, or had a partnership with this autonomous trucking startup called Waabi to increase autonomous trucking. And so, you know, what this really means is trucks that are driving on the highway without a person pushing the pedal and holding the wheel. There's still a professional there in the truck overseeing everything. But, you know, this is a truck that is driving autonomously on the highway. And so, you know, I think a lot of folks who are big proponents of driverless technology really believe there's a big...
Well, he just cut out there. I'm sure we'll get him back. Are you still there, Jim? Jim Dahlke should be back on with us in just a moment. You know, the question I was just about to ask him was, I wonder if an autonomous truck outside of Tutopolis, Illinois, carrying anhydrous ammonia, which is used for farmers for fertilizer. It's also used as a coolant in warehouses that you see all across the highways in Illinois and across the country. I wonder if an autonomous truck would have been less likely to crash in that situation. Clearly, human beings aren't making perfect decisions here. The story about that in the paper you may have seen today was that it is believed that somebody was trying to pass that truck when a multi-vehicle crash took place and several people were killed and injured, to say nothing of a plume of anhydrous ammonia, which then wafted over little Tutopolis, Illinois. So I wonder if as scary as it is, the idea that somebody wouldn't be behind the wheel of a truck, I wonder how much better it would be if somebody might. I was just reminding our listeners, Jim is back with us now, that there was a terrible truck crash downstate in Tutopolis with a hazardous substance. And I wonder if that had been an autonomous truck, if that truck would have seen somebody trying to pass it and automatically have made a decision to mitigate the circumstances around the crash. I wonder if you have a thought about that, Jim.
Yeah, you know, John, safety is a big piece of the conversation here with autonomous vehicles. And proponents really believe that it can be a safer solution. You know, obviously, when, you know, you've got a human behind the wheel who may be a little tired, you know, that comes into play in terms of overall safety. And so, you know, proponents of this technology believe that autonomous trucking can ultimately be safer as the technology continues to improve. And so, you know, with Uber having now 100,000 miles on the road, they're starting to develop a pretty good database here of information about how this is going and how they're going to plan to use it in the future. And, you know, from this conference that Uber had last week, they're really leaning all into AI. So I would only expect to see, you know, more continued autonomous vehicle driving from Uber here.
I'm going to pronounce this company name. Tell me if I get it right. Evozine?
Yeah, Evozine. Yeah, pretty close. So, yeah, Evozine in the news last week, you know, they just raised $81 million. This is a biotech company here in Chicago that's using AI for drug discovery. Really, really interesting technology here out of Evozine. Essentially, what they do is, you know, they make novel proteins using AI. And, you know, this has a wide range of potential use cases. You know, you could look at these, like creating different enzymes that convert carbon to energy or increase the nutritional value of food with these proteins. But, you know, one example of their technology is creating new drugs, and they just landed $81 million in funding. Really, you know, as we've been talking about, funding has been hard to come by for many Chicago startups in 2023. So $81 million, a really nice chunk of change here for Evozine. They made big moves recently by naming Mike Gamson as their CEO. Folks in the Chicago tech and startup scene know that name. He's a very, very active angel investor, invested in a lot of startups. He was one of the earliest checks in Cameo, actually, one of the first investors in that business, and was leading the LinkedIn's office here in Chicago as well. So very seasoned tech entrepreneur now at the helm of Evozine, and now they got $81 million in the bank to continue their AI drug discovery platform.
It's not all the stories we want to talk about today, but it's all the time we've got. Let's catch up on more of this sort of stuff next week.
Thanks, John.
Okay. Thank you, sir. That's Jim Dahlke, national editor, American Inno. More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A Chicago startup that makes software to help companies track shipments has moved its global headquarters to a new location in the West Loop. Four kites moved into the 45th floor of Bank of America Tower at 110 North Wacker. The company's office will cover about 12,000 square feet. 150 employees work at the headquarters. Chicago Inno reports Four Kites is growing. In the last year, it's seen a 37% increase in customers and 40% growth for both shipments using its platform and carriers in its network. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, how about you, Steve Alexander?
Thank you, and we have a big announcement today for high school students in Illinois. Something pretty cool, after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us. Truck season is here. Put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, on the phone is...
Tom Welge, President, Gilster Mary Lee Corporation.
Gilster Mary Lee is the private label food manufacturing company based downstate in Chester with several plants in Illinois and Missouri, and the company that made Flutie Flakes.
We are. We call them celebrity cereals. We started back with Flutie Flakes 20-some years ago and have grown that across different sports, music, pop culture, celebrities through the years, including Patrick Mahomes and even Bob Ross, the painter of PBS fame.
Bob Ross?
Yeah, you know, a license from his estate, and he is on a box of cereal that we made.
Okay, well, here's where Illinois high school students come in.
We have created a contest, Create a Crunch, whereby high school students can submit an essay. And if their essay is selected, they will be able to develop and launch a breakfast cereal which features their own high school.
And the winner will get 2,500 boxes of cereal that the school can use for fundraising, food banks, or whatever it wants. Last year's winner, out of more than 300 essays, was a student at Red Bud High School downstate. And from now through the end of this month, students can submit an essay about AI.
Basically, we're asking the students to imagine how AI could help in manufacturing. And on the flip side, are there any things that we should be concerned about or be aware of as we integrate more AI into our lives and, in this case, manufacturing?
Essays are due by the end of October.
And we will have a team from the Illinois Manufacturers Association help us select the finalists from all the entries.
And to enter,
submit an essay to Create a Crunch at GilsterMaryLee.com and check with their schools as well.
Once more,
Create a Crunch at GilsterMaryLee.com.
I like it. And why not do a John Williams cereal, too? On today's food calendar, it's National Fried Scallops Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Kevin Brown is the CEO at Let Us Entertain You Restaurants. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, and you've got a new business venture. Huh, Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Always a pleasure to hear you and be with you.
Yeah, likewise. And so you're lending some of your expertise or your company's expertise to other restaurants, is that right?
That's correct. We started this actually about 20 or 25 years ago under the direction of John Buchanan. We were doing, you know, menu and organizational systems and operations and really helping people assess their business. But this business has evolved just like our company has evolved. You know, we've gotten larger. I've got 80 partners, and we're getting a lot of requests for the things that we do. We're, instead of working with individual restaurants like we did in the early days, now we're working with real estate companies on sort of master planning and entertainment, working with private equity firms on strategy, growth, involvement, even potentially acquisition. We've got a couple golf resorts, both one in Wisconsin and one in Oregon. We're working on festivals. We're working on with hotels, and we're working now, just recently, we're working with a resort organization.
All of these are the food space, though, right? All of these with
mainly
the service
the
delivery of food, yeah.
Yes, and hospitality, you know, sort of entertainment, and it's not limited just to food. It's they want leadership and training development, hospitality development, so there's opportunities to sort of expand the things that we've kind of worked on over the years.
Is it unusual that you would be advising people who could be your competitors?
We're careful about that. You know, I don't think we would do a lot of people that are right here on our back door unless we think we were going to work with them. Most of the clients that we're working with right now are national clients.
Yeah.
But we are sensitive to that, though.
So give me an example, then, of somebody reaching out to you and what you do with or for them.
Well, like we're working with a group right now that's got about a They've got 13 units with two or more under development. They want to see how they can basically double the size of their business. So we take a look at their organizational structure. We assess how they actually operate. We would work with every one of the different restaurants, assess that, then help them put together what would be leadership and development and systems and help them get to the next level.
Hmm. Is there, I guess it's all kinds of menu options then, right? Like it could be if somebody wants to open an Italian restaurant, a fish house, it'd be all, and maybe that doesn't even matter, right? It's more the business acumen rather than maybe the menu items. Talk about that.
Well, we do provide culinary support. I mean, that's how really originally how it all started. And I think if you look about our organization, we've got 65 different concepts right now. So it's sort of we can touch a lot of bases with that sort of talent and culinary. But we absolutely are still working on food within this sort of systems and growth and operations. A lot of menu analysis, too.
Is there a mistake you think a lot of businesses are making, or at least an area for growth or opportunity that they're missing?
A lot of the times it's just, do they have the right systems in place? Do they have the right training in place? You know, it's sort of the blocking and tackling still makes a difference. So just as long as they have sort of, you know, good programs in place, good sanitation in place, we help them with sort of taking a look at having things operate on a systematic basis.
About a week ago, we talked to some of the folks from Four Star Restaurant Group. We asked them about increasing the sub-minimum wage in Chicago. Does that impact mm-hmm. you all, and what's your thought about that over the next 5 years?
Oh, it definitely has an impact. You know, I think it's not the people who work for us, the people who work in the front of the house. I mean, we've seen what they make with their gratuities and what they're paid on the current wage. They make quite a bit more than the minimum wage. And we think that can be supported. You know, we think that you can continue to go that way. I think this has a bearing on a lot of restaurant groups, and especially a lot of individual restaurants. It's just, you know, we've been through a lot the past couple of years, and I think this is going to prove to be difficult.
Yeah. Well, so do you have a map to how you're going to manage that? Are you going to have to hire less staff, or how are you going to increase a 40% human cost increase over 5 years?
Yeah, it's tricky. You know, you have to. It'll be depending on what the final number is, how they graduated in. It's something we have to sort of work with, and just, you know, we have to be careful. The last thing we'd want to do is cut back on hospitality. Nobody wants to see that happen. Not to us, not to anyone, and it's not good for the city.
I don't suppose, though, that it's exact. That is, the costs go up for these workers. That's not the only cost that goes into the bill. So I shouldn't anticipate a 40% increase in the cost of a steak, because there are other costs that might stay the same. I wonder what percent increase then menu items would have to increase in order to accommodate the employees that will get an increase.
Well, I think it just goes back to what we're working on the consulting end of it, is that we're trying to help people run their restaurants and their businesses more efficiently. And when you run more efficiently, you reduce waste. You get, you know, you can get more competitive in terms of looking at your pricing. And I don't think every expense is going to go up. Certainly, this is just the labor expense. But in our industry and in our business, you know, food, beverage, and labor are the drivers of your business. They're the drivers of our expense. We want to be careful with this. We understand it, but we don't want to do anything that would hurt the guest.
I like the chances. Let us entertain you, restaurants. Boy, we love the brand. We love all of the plates around the city. And sounds like folks like the advice that you're giving them too, Kevin. Very interesting. Thanks for kind of cluing us in today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Kevin Brown is the CEO at Let Us Entertain You.